The year is 1974, and Bob Crispin has just invented the mountain bike. This is some kick-ass
Oregon history. Hello and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast in the year 2014, where we simplify the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores. Simplifying the good life. I can't believe I just repeated you.
Oh, it's okay. No, we're serious about it. We're so serious we say it twice.
That's right. Damn it all. Broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally, with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycles, trains and transit, and if you didn't already know, simpler living and simplifying the good life. And today, for the first time, mountain bikes.
This is the very first time, I think, that we have covered mountain biking.
Specifically, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to create a new category on the website just for this. We're here with Mr. Bob Crispin. Hello.
Hello, hello.
And thank you for joining us. You needed a mountain bike and did not have one. In fact, they did not exist. So you made one way back in the day.
This is a fact. In 1973, I made my first mountain bike. Dealing for the first time with the concept of snow in Spokane, moving from sunny Cali, a road bike with 20C wide wheels just didn't hold the snow.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to go into all the details of that in just a moment. Thank you again for coming out. We are enjoying, appropriately, New Belgium's Fat Tire Amber Ale. And it's been just long enough since I've had one of these that I'm actually enjoying it quite a bit. So
New Belgium, please bring your mountain bike festival back to Portland.
Yeah, what happened to that? Because it used to be, Tour de Fat? Is that what you were thinking
Tour
of?
Tour de Fat.
Tour de Fat is amazing.
I went on all of them, and they decided they weren't selling enough beer here.
So. That's weird, because doesn't New Belgium sponsor the Film by Bike Festival?
I believe they do. I'm going to have to go back and look at the sponsor list. I think they do. I believe they may be the sponsor for the kickoff party.
Yeah.
For Film by Bike.
Oh, shit. Speaking of Film by Bike.
Guess who's on the jury? Emily Finch.
Not me.
Who I saw at the grocery store yesterday.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, just walking in and all of a sudden there's a famous person, so I said hello. Also, I am on the jury this year for Film by Bike, which I'm kind of excited about. I almost feel like I don't deserve to be there. And if you read my little blurb, that's exactly what it sounds like.
Right.
I'm like, I don't really have anything to say about movies.
Why am I here? Who am I and what am I doing here?
But I'm honored and that'll be fun to be a part of. So that comes up in April and the juring. What do you say? What's the...
Judging,
yes. What's the verb form of juror? The adjudication of the films.
There you go.
Will take place just in a couple of weekends. And as I understand, there is much whiskey to be had.
Ooh.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Was this the event that's held at Cinema 21?
This is at the Clinton Street Theater.
Okay, because I did show that at a film event at Cinema 21 back about 5 years ago.
Oh, the Tacagnolo?
Yeah.
Nice, nice. Which is the affectionate nickname and somewhat rib-poking nickname of your bicycle, which you created, Mr. Bob.
Yes.
Should I call you Mr. Bob or just Bob?
Mr. Bob is what I'm called around my family and
okay.
all my homies. So.
Okay, yeah, that's what you refer to yourself as, I think. So I figure I'll try and follow suit.
Most excellent.
Yeah. There's one other thing here.
On the table.
When Ellie Blue came, Ellie Blue, the Taking the Lane... author, editor, and all-around person in charge. Yes. She gave us a couple free zines, and one of them was Bikes in Space. I'm holding in my hand here now. And I feel bad because the first thing I asked her was like, is it kind of silly? And I felt bad about asking that as soon as I asked it. But I sat down and read the whole thing. There's some 10 or 12 entries in here, little short stories.
Read the subtitle of that.
What was that? Oh, yes. Bikes in Space, a Feminist Science Fiction Anthology.
Yes.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And turns out it's not silly. It's actually pretty fantastic. It does what science fiction always does, which is to dig up issues that we're dealing with in everyday life and put them in a new context so you can recognize them freshly. So
it doesn't have all the cultural and social baggage that it normally would if,
yeah.
you know, you and I sat down and said, let's talk about healthcare.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, anyways, it was pretty good. You have not read it yet, Aaron?
Not yet.
So I'm going to lend it to you.
Oh, Merry Christmas to me.
Merry Christmas to you. And to the listeners, I'm trying to remember if we've done a contest before or not. If not, this will be our first contest. As at least the first one in several years. And I can't think of what the first one would have been.
Tenth caller.
Yes.
Right now.
But no, let's, I'm making this up as I go, but let's say, send us an email with something that you would do with a bike in space. Our favorite answer gets this copy. Once Aaron has finished reading it, we'll mail it to you. So
sometime next year.
Yeah, exactly.
Does this include on the moon?
I think there is. There is on the moon. There's also a story about someone who...
So as long as you've left, let's say the ionosphere.
Yes, yes.
Because okay. I'm thinking you could jump some great gaps.
Above upper orbit, yeah.
1/5 gravity, yeah.
Wicked air, yeah. Or lack thereof. Yeah. So yeah, it's pretty great anyway. So my apologies to Ellie for asking a stupid question, and congratulations to her for curating a great collection of stories. So there's that. I'm going to toss this over to you, Aaron.
Excellent.
And speaking of apologizing to people, I must also apologize to my new friend Connor, whom I met on the Amtrak train traveling from Boston to Portland. He was making the same length of trip as I was coming back from Boston. I met him briefly on the smoke stop at Springfield, Massachusetts on the first train, the Lakeshore Limited, and didn't even get his name, just said a couple of sentences, hey, what's up, that sort of thing. And then we bumped into each other again, like in Minneapolis, Milwaukee, something like that. And I believe it was somewhere in western Montana after the sun had set on the Empire Builder that he had been out there and kind of been driven away from the observation car by a very political conversation. Some fresh-faced college kid was debating the finer points of socialism versus capitalism.
Oh, that's always fun.
It's great, yeah. But it was one of those...
You know you're going to change hearts and minds on the Amtrak train.
Oh, seriously. No, the funniest part of that was like there was this lady who initially was not part of the conversation, but couldn't help but be drawn into that conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And then felt the need shortly thereafter to leave the conversation because she couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
So she got into it and then she was like, oh, shit.
She just made that college kid's day right there.
Maybe.
I mean, poor her, but, he's feeling really good right now.
No, I think he was actually all distraught after she left. He was like, oh, that ended too soon. So, anyways, I sit down. I'm reading this book that I was enjoying, and I'm on the super line, and there's this package of pretzels sitting there right between the window and the floor. And I think to myself, oh,
free pretzels.
Maybe free pretzels. So I pick up the bag. I look around. I'm like, hey, you, fresh-faced college kid, you were sitting here. Are these your pretzels? He said, nope. So I opened them and started eating them. And then Connor from Massachusetts comes back and he's like, oh man, you're eating my pretzels.
Oh no.
Which is exactly what I had feared. So I apologized profusely to him. And I did give him a sticker for the show. So Connor, if you're listening, cool. My apologies for eating your pretzels again.
Yeah.
So anyways, cool guy. He's actually on his way up to BC somewhere to work on an organic farm, woofing.
Oh, wow.
One of those guys. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyways, riding the train cross country is awesome. Everything that's not Portland is really cold right now. Chicago, actually, I still have, if you check out my shoes, I still have Chicago salt on my sneakers I wore while trudging through the snow over there. The snow is gone. The moisture is gone. All that is left is the salt that they clear the roads with. And Cleveland, I think, or Toledo. No, it was Cleveland.
Probably
when I
Cleveland,
got off the train.
They're the ones who get all of the wind off the, off the lake area.
Yeah, and it was like 3:30 in the morning, and it was like 30 degrees below or something like that. It was ridiculous.
They always get, whenever, growing up in Southeast Michigan, whenever we got something, they got it way worse. And, having to drive like from Pittsburgh over to, around Toledo area.
You have to go through Toledo.
You have to go through Cleveland.
And
it was always kind of harrowing if you were doing it during the winter.
Seriously.
Growing up in Monterey, it snowed my sophomore year of high school for the first time in 32 years.
First time in 32 years.
And I had a gnarly flu and couldn't go out. Cars were sliding off the road. We had what they called rainy day session in grade school. When I was in grade school,
wait.
They had no indoor play areas.
Oh.
So when it was raining, we didn't have recess, so we got out 40 minutes early. And they would announce on the radio, like, snow days here, rainy day session here, get your kids 40 minutes early.
Rainy day session.
Rainy day session. Huh. That's how little it rained that there.
That's something that does not happen in Portland.
Grade school was, and you never had track practice. I was a runner. If we didn't have track practice here in Portland, you wouldn't have track.
That's amazing. Wow. Congratulations. You're one of the privileged ones.
Yeah, I lived in Spokane 9 years, so I could sneak here with Washington plates. You know,
right.
Wasn't coming up with
exactly.
Plates, no way.
Well, you know, that is kind of a mistake.
Yeah, not a good thing to do. You got to have some snow training. And,
exactly. You build up your cred in Eastern Washington.
Yeah, you feel like this place is warm after you've been in Spokane for 9 years.
Yeah, I was actually on the platform at the Amtrak station in Spokane. It was like 3 days ago now. I still feel like I'm kind of on train time.
I
was wondering.
The feeling of train time to me is like halfway through the ride on the Empire Builder somewhere in like eastern Montana, or like right after Minot, North Dakota, as you're going west. I get the feeling of like I have always been on this train, and I will always be on this train, and there is nothing else before or after. And just kind of like settling into that, which maybe sounds terrible to some people, but that's one of the things I enjoy. Because like when you're on an airplane, you're always thinking, it's going to be over. Like, I just got to get through it.
Yeah. I can't wait till I'm back off.
On the train, if you take that perspective, it's going to suck for like 3 days. And so if you just kind of have this like in-between state, I kind of like if you're a C.S. Lewis fan, the wood between the worlds from The Magician's Nephew. It's not here. It's not there. It's somewhere else. Wow. So, yeah. Anyways, so that. And lastly, I did a lot of reading on the future of reading and our brains and the internet.
Sounds pretty heavy.
Yeah, it was very heavy. Sven Burkert's The Gutenberg Elegies, which was referenced in episode 14 of the Sprocket podcast. My brother-in-law, Adam, gave these two books to me. And then the other is The Shallows by, I believe, Nicholas Carr is the author. And just talking about what happens when text goes electronic and what it does to the way that our brain processes information and whether that makes you a smarter or less smart person. So fascinating stuff. I would like to kind of do maybe a show on that someday. So we shall see.
That'd be like our heaviest show ever.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, I wonder if we could actually get in touch with some of those guys, just like get the author's perspective from the horse's mouth, as it were.
Yeah.
I'd heard that when print became cheap and available to the masses, that people thought that everybody would become vegetables just reading too much.
Right.
And then when the radio came out, they thought everybody would become vegetables just radioing out too much.
And then television.
TV, I think, really did work. I think it's worse than the internet. You know, watching. I think the internet at least is more interactive than just sitting around watching some daytime game show. You know,
right.
You're kind of... You're looking for things instead of just sitting there going, oh boy, look who's winning the $64,000 question or whatever.
Yeah. You get to choose your programming at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think I'll save my own thoughts on the matter for when I have time to expound upon them. So,
sure.
Yeah. Aaron, last 2 weeks, what happened for you?
Oh, not much, really.
Okay. You took the red hair among horses out for a ride?
Yeah, we haven't really done anything too long yet. Oh, but I found this out. So getting a lot of stuff from the bike farm.
Oh, yes.
My hookups there. But one of the things with that is, you know, you're getting used gear. And my seat post, the little grooves that hold, I don't know what that part is, but... That piece that angles your seat.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
All of those grooves are all stripped out. So
okay.
If I have too much on my back, which unfortunately I don't have any racks right now. So
oh, right. So
I'm
you're
carrying everything on my back.
Yes.
And I, you know, get on my saddle. Unless I have that bolt really wrenched down. By the way, I'm going to need an Allen wrench from you after this.
Oh, sure. I can help you with that.
Unless I have that bolt really wrenched down, and even that doesn't help. Like those grooves will just slide. You know, and so then I end up with, you know, the nose of the saddle pointing slightly upward.
So it kind of looks like, I don't know, a BMX bike you would see downtown, for example.
Sure.
Or something
and,
like
and
that.
And it kind of hurts.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that, man.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. And I get off every now and then and have to adjust it.
Yeah. It's kind of like pumping up a flat tire. It's like not quite, the leak is not quite fast enough for you to actually change the flat. You just keep on pumping it up every day until it runs down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need to find some new parts then.
Yeah. But I mean, that was sort of the understanding, was, you know, build it up as necessary and then update as necessary. Yeah.
These are bike farm parts.
Yeah.
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 Exactly.
So I'm not terribly heartbroken about that. But yeah, riding her around the city. I haven't crossed the bridges until just yesterday.
You mean into downtown or West Portland?
Yeah. Yeah.
So over the Willamette, the red hair went.
Yes. And
not
the red
here.
Hair
over.
Among horses.
Among horses.
Yes.
Excuse me.
You got to say the whole thing.
This is the name, Mr. Bob, of the surly disc trucker over there.
The red hair among horses.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah, I don't know why. I never bothered to go downtown. And so I not only crossed over once, but four times.
Yeah. Just, well, there's less to do downtown than one would think.
Yeah, especially like by the time I get around to, because I'm not really a morning person.
Oh, sure.
Sadly, because that's when a lot of the cool rides happen.
Also the Sunrise Coffee Club.
Yeah, which I will do eventually.
Me too. Someday when I'm not working.
It's going to happen, Chris, I promise.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's when all the rides happen. But I'm not really a morning person. It takes me a while to get out and around, especially on my day off. And so usually by the time I'm out close to downtown, it's already like, you know, 3-ish.
Uh-huh. And then the evening rush.
Yeah.
And there's no critical mass ride to join. I mean, there might be. But it's not big. It is not of critical mass.
It's not quite critical.
Yeah, exactly. Well, cool. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
It is 2014.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I think that's everything that I wanted to talk about. I cannot think of anything else. So we'll turn to you, Mr. Bob. Let's talk a little bit about the Tankignola.
Okay. Well, mentioning 2014 makes me realize that it's 41 years since I built the first one.
That's a long time, I guess.
Yeah. I was raised in the California, Monterey Peninsula, Pacific Grove, California. Moderate weather. We're known to have Augusts that have more fog than. Who was the author that said the coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco?
Yes. Yeah, is that Twain? Sounds like a Twain.
Yeah, I think it was Twain. Yeah. And Monterey's a lot the same way, but we didn't have snow and things like that. And I became an avid roadie then, and everyone was getting away from the paperboy bike, the cruisers. Everybody wanted light and fast, and you could get further than your borders of your town. I ended up pedaling to Yosemite a couple summers.
Oh, nice.
And
how far is that from Monterey?
About 220 with quite a bit of climbing.
That's a fair amount of distance.
We carried our own jars of peanut butter and everything. I mean, we were really prepared to be light, you know, on J.C. Higgins Sears 10 speeds with no small sprocket on the front. I think they were 52, 48. But anyway, I moved to Spokane. Because I wasn't about to pay $20,000 for a house down there in 72. Like $20,000, it's $200 a month for life. No way, I'm out of there. So I moved to Spokane, bought a nice Victorian for $10,000, moved in, settled down. In those days, you could buy a house if you were a couple making minimum wage.
Okay.
I had a Grand Jubilee, the Motobacon Grand Jubilee, which fell down in the snow a lot. had... you know, 20C wide tires on it, fell down snow a lot. So I got a cruiser and had a little problem walking up the South Hill in Spokane. So I decided I wanted a multi-speed bike that would go in the snow. And BMX wasn't around yet, so there was no wide caliber brake. So a kickback brake, of course, would not work with a derailleur. So I looked around. I didn't know about drum brakes, but I walked into a shop and observed that J.C. Penney's had a bike with a Shimano disc brake on it. Heavy, but very solid brake. So I ordered the brake from the bike shop and put derailleurs and the brake on the cruiser frame and began to ride around in the snow. The most fun I had, I would come up behind a roadie. I was in very good shape then. I was a sub 430 miler. I was fast. I was good. And I would get behind a roadie slightly to the left pulling Spokane South Hill so they couldn't see my derailleurs, and they would look back in horror that some guy on a 40s cruiser was tailing them. They'd gear down and I'd gear down, and they would not know I was gearing down, and I had a great time tailing people like that.
Did you pass them as well, or did you just kind of ride behind them and
I
make
would
them
tend
nervous?
To ride behind them, and sometimes I would pass them. I would usually pass them just before making a left turn, so they would still not see the derailleurs. Everybody being the light and fast thought the bike was kind of stupid, and why would you have it, especially when I rode it in the summer.
Yeah, so this is trending. Like, everyone wants a lighter and faster bike. Is carbon fiber a thing yet, or are we talking like aluminum or just lighter steel?
Just, you know, Reynolds 531 was a thing at the time. Reynolds 531 chrome alloy.
Okay.
And Columbus tubing. Those were the things that the Mossies and the Cinellis and the Italian bikes had. Motobacon Grand Jubilee was 531 Reynolds. And aluminum was yet to show up. But much lighter than the paperboy bikes. And BMX, I think when BMX came around is when people started to be aware that there was more than roads. And I think that kind of led to the mountain bike. But I built the Tankanolo 2 because the seat post was bending on the cruiser frame. It was too small, and those early bikes had really narrow seat posts. So it was literally bending backwards.
Mm. Kind of like Aaron's, in a way.
In a way.
Yeah, exactly. It was the same kind of thing with the weak point. So I got a Schwinn Varsity. I worked at a place that had an acetylene torch, and I widened the frame and so it would hold the 26 by 2.25 rims from the old cruisers, steel rims, of course, and put the brake and the whole thing on there. Had what they called Alpine gearing in the day because it had a 38 in the front, which was considered Alpine gearing in the day. I believe it's 52, 48, 38 or 36, 38, I think.
All right. And for, I'm not especially facile with numbers when it comes to gearing ratios. So what, is this, this is a better choice than was available maybe in the day. Like that was towards the upper range of
you do. 1-to-1 was, you know, 36 to 36 was big time, low gearing.
Okay.
Most of your road bikes had a 52-48 in the front and a 12-to-28 in the back, which was nowhere near 1-to-1. You had to get out of the saddle to climb anything. And they thought that was really good for you to hammer.
Really just wear out those knees for you.
Yeah. And so I lived there for 9 years, and I didn't own a car for most of that. Pedaled winter and summer. Be it 9 degrees out, I'd be out in the snow.
Yeah.
And
how was that?
It was great.
Uh-huh.
It was great. You know, there was times when it was icy enough that and you couldn't get knobbies then. The tires on it, they didn't have the knobbies for the, but they did at least have the wide tires.
Okay.
And so we did a lot of riding. And then I discovered trails in the summer because I was a runner and I knew where all these trails were. I'd train on them and I'd go out and bike on them. And we did some photo sessions up in the trails and we rode and had a pretty good time. I had no one to ride with, though, so it wasn't like I did a lot of it. And I moved to Portland in 81 and traded Tankanola for a road bike and commenced to become a roadie again.
Yeah, and you were telling us a story before we started taping about the how you kind of you realized at some point that you might want that back, the Tankanola, the original.
Yeah. And then as I walked into a bike shop, and it was either 83 or 84, something like that, I go, holy shit, there's nothing but fat tire bikes in this place.
Right.
And I had one, and I want it back. So I posted in the Portland Wheelman, and you know, anybody have that bike? I want to buy it back. Never heard from anyone. Figured it was gone. Not going to find another disc brake. Walked into Salvation Army in St. John's, and there was a J.C. Penney's bike all rusted out with that disc brake on it. And I knew everything else was obtainable, all the Schwinn Varsity stuff. City Bikes and Community Bike Center would have that. So I rebuilt the Tankanola to as close to detail as I could. Got the old 40s rims, got the derailleurs, pretty much cheap 70s derailleurs from that era, cheap seat. And Rust-Oleum still made the royal blue.
The exact same color.
The exact same color. They still make it. And I had painted Chinese red for a while, too. So Weir Cycle in North Portland displayed the bike for years, and I wanted another one to ride, so I found another disc brake by luck, built another one, painted it the royal red, the Chinese red. And that bike now sits at the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame or in a freight car somewhere between Crested Butte, Colorado, and Fairfax, Marin County, California, where the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame is moving to.
Oh, there we go. So they're in transit at this point?
Yes. I sent them the bike last fall. They were going to put it on display, and all of a sudden they announced that I think there was enough money to say, let's move to where the real sport started, Marin.
Right. And Marin is kind of the, I guess there's some argument, right, about like who actually invented the mountain bike, because you came to this independently. Like you didn't, you weren't inspired by any other mountain bikes. They didn't exist when you came up with Tacagnolo, correct?
Yeah. I have a whole book here called The Birth of Dirt, which argues about what is an invention. And they say that it's not enough to invent it. You have to either patent it or you have to create an audience for it. You have to. Huh. I feel Russ Mohan invented the mountain bike.
Okay.
He was seen at a race in Marin with Gary Fisher looking at his derailleurs on a single speed. And 2 weeks later, Gary Fisher had a derailleur bike. But Russ Mohan, a group called the Dirt Club or something from Santa Cruz or somewhere in that area, came up to Marin, raced once, and disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And they took him about 20 years to find Russ Mohan. And he just...
just dropped off the earth.
Hiding in the hills of northern Cali. And but he... there was another guy named Rodney Rahm who made one in 66, documented it being taken on an aircraft carrier. He went to Nam with it, peddled in Southeast Asia with it, had the drum brakes, the motorcycle levers, met the spec more than mine in 66.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Speaking of the motorcycle levers, that's the thing you don't have on this one, right?
Yeah, mine meets the Berto is the name of the author, Birth of Dirt, and mine meets all the specs except it doesn't have high bars.
Okay.
And it doesn't have moto levers.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a woman in Marin who did race mountain bikes in the early, late 70s with down bars, but I don't remember her name, but other than that, it was wide bars.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Aaron, you and I have both done a fair amount of off-road riding
with
down bars, I guess. It's like when we did Crater Lake, you had...
I had 28C.
Yeah, wheels. That's true, yeah.
And I still, am maybe out of stubbornness, I think. Still am insistent on, wanting to tour on 28Cs, even though, these are 26-inch wheels now, so they don't even come... Well, some of them come that thin, but not a lot of them. Definitely not a touring tire.
Yeah.
These are 1.5s, I think.
I think so, yeah. You'd have to work long and hard.
To about 35.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, you're about right.
But anyhow, 28Cs going through the dirt, not too much of a problem, but I'm also kind of a small guy. So,
right.
You know, I don't have a whole lot of weight coming down on the bike. So, you know, going through mud, I didn't really get stuck too much so long as I got enough momentum ahead of time.
Right, right. Plan ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
Just steer carefully.
I had more trouble coming down on some off-roads, not on the Crater Lake trip, coming down from Powell Butte.
Okay.
Once.
Yeah, the hill down toward the Springwater?
Yes, exactly.
I love climbing back up that.
I never went up those. I should have.
I used to run track, and my body won't let me run track anymore. I'd still be running it. But that's equivalent to that hill is equivalent to running a full-on 2 mile. When you're at the top of that baby, you are done.
Yeah.
I love pulling that hill.
It is kind of like wringing you out like a wash rag or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just you can pace yourself so it feels like, you know, running it all out 8 laps around a quarter-mile track. I love the feel of it.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about the mountain biking scene here now. There is less in Portland than many would like. So where do you go, Mr. Bob?
I go with, I think Forest Park could handle at least one single track trail that went from Germantown Road to the nearest coffee shop in Northwest.
Okay.
I think the environment, they say the environment's so fragile. I think if it's really that fragile, they probably shouldn't let people hike in it. But they had an event here to try to promote it. Mountain biking there, and they talked about they wanted to kind of show the gentler side of mountain biking, and someone put on a video of people jumping stuff and being all crazy, and it just completely turned off the friends of it was like, I'm just going, oh, why did you show this video to the friends of Forest Park, you know, people taking air
the gentler side
getting completely sideways and turns and stuff, and I'm like, this isn't going to win it.
And right. That doesn't illustrate the point they're trying to make.
No.
Well, when in fact, again, I don't know a whole lot about mountain biking, so correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a fair amount of skill involved in simply remaining upright in certain situations, like being able to stay on the track so that you're not damaging the environment, and being able to maintain your balance as you're going downhill instead of losing control or maintaining control. It's not all about sliding and jumping and whatnot, is it? Or
well, and another thing is in the design of the trail itself. I went to Mammoth Mountain in Cali, which really pushes mountain biking in their ski areas. You go up to 11,000 feet on a tram, and then you can spend 6 hours going downhill. And they have actually a one-way trail called. They have two trails. It's uptown, downtown. And it, the one-way down one is banked such that you don't have to shred out and get sideways.
Ah.
You just can fly. And so if you design a trail properly, it helps you handle your line so you don't have to get all messed up.
Sure.
And if the trails are well cared for, and the mountain bike community seems very willing to keep the trails up, so I think Portland needs some more so that we don't have to put our bikes on cars, which is kind of counter the bike culture.
Sure.
I think it's part of why Portland doesn't really embrace mountain biking, is they see us all putting our bikes on our cars and
driving out
SUVs and heading out
to
Post Canyon or.
Yeah.
And that's just because that's the only place you can go where it's actually a hospitable environment where you're not going to bother someone or you're not going to be trespassing on private property, et cetera.
Yeah, and Paul Butte's our best because you can go out to Springwater. You can get there by the bike. You don't have to get in the car. And then you climb that happy little hill and play around up there. But there's not a lot of playroom up there. But I think Forest Park can handle it. And Time will tell.
There's also that Gateway Green project that, if I'm not mistaken, they had a Kickstarter project for, and it was fairly successful. So I believe there will be north of Gateway, towards the airport, on the east side of Rocky Butte, basically right there next to the
some
freeway.
Single tracks.
I think there's going to be a park built at some point for mountain bike skills. So there will be more facilities as time goes along, but. But time will tell. Yeah.
This is a secret I'm letting out. There is a half mile of single track on the bluff by the University of Portland. Between University of Portland and St. John's is a whole half mile of beautiful single track.
Oh, wait, is this
down along the bluff, down where they used to have all the graffiti and all that wonderful stuff that they tore down there below the bluff? If you head towards St. John's along the railroad tracks, you can find there's some really pretty single track, and you'll see bald eagles and stuff like that, but it's about 3/4 of a mile. That's Portland single track.
I'm blanking on the name of the street, but there's a road from University of Portland in North Portland near St. John's that drops down to
Grant Hooten. Is it Hooten?
I think it's Hooten.
Yeah,
Van Hooten.
Yeah, Van Hooten. Yeah,
yeah.
If you're on Lombard, you're at the 31 Flavors ice cream store, and you head south, you'll drop down into the University of Portland owns all that property now, where all the creosote plants that were.
Oh, really?
All that beautiful graffiti that they did down there.
Didn't realize that. Interesting. So, yeah. And it was also a super fun site, right? Like, there's a bunch of contamination that's been there historically.
We got stopped for being in there, and these guys came out in pickup trucks with the windows rolled down, blowing dust everywhere. And they told us that we needed to wash our bike tires and our feet before we went home because it was so dangerous.
And they're blowing dust all over you guys.
And they really were trying to put the scare on us for just being on the property. And
sure.
So I asked the guy about the science of the project, and he goes, "You're not showing enough respect here." And I says, "Well, I respect you, and I'm going to leave your property, but I had a problem with the difference between respect and fear."
Right.
I respected that they wanted us off the property. I knew they were scaring us because they drove off with dust flying in the windows of their open pickup afterwards.
Yeah.
But
big dudes. Those trucks mean business.
Yeah. Somehow the trucks protect them from all the dust coming in their window where we needed the one. They actually had us get a hose and wash our tires off and carry the bikes.
Oh, my gosh.
To the railroad tracks. And then.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what I would call a phallic extension, I think.
Yeah.
So there's also down in that area, there's the train tracks where all the trains cross on the rail bridge between downtown, the Northwest Industrial Area,
right,
and the little rail corridor that goes up to the Columbia River. And then along there, there's what you're talking about, that single track.
Yeah.
It's just this beautiful little kind of forgotten area almost.
Yeah.
Eventually, if you go farther north, you end up at Cathedral Park, I believe.
Yeah, you pop out at Cathedral Park. So you drop down below the U of Portland, and it comes out at Cathedral Park. that area. And it's, there's a little cove there where there's a bunch of
boats. Yeah. Pirate Cove.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the boat with the pirate flag on it, I don't believe is there any longer.
Yeah.
At least recently it hasn't been, but maybe the pirate goes and comes back, and who knows.
There was one boat there last time I was over there. It looked like it was just basically somebody's garbage boat.
This is where you put all your stuff.
It's like it's just a bunch of garbage bags on there.
Done with these soup cans. Let's put them over here on the boat. Yeah.
Let's put them on this boat. We'll eventually, you know, just take the anchor off and let it go.
That's it. Yeah. Gosh, it reminds me of that great novel Couch by Mr. Parzybach about eventually ending up like afloat in the Pacific Ocean after being knocked out somewhere on Highway 30. Couch by, was it?
Benjamin Parzybach.
Yeah. It's a great, great novel. The last thing I was thinking of about mountain bike access was Sandy Ridge is another great spot that seems like it has fairly decent facilities. And eventually, if I'm not mistaken, there is work being done and plans for non-motorized access from the Springwater Corridor out to Sandy and then up the Highway 26 corridor from there.
Sweet.
So you can bike there now. It's a long ways and it's not necessarily fun, but that will also get better, I think, as time goes along. So, the future may be good for us. We'll see.
This would be excellent. Yeah.
Have you ridden Sandy Ridge?
No, not. I've gone out to Vernonia. I know they're doing work out in Vernonia, but again, that's car on the rack, you know, bike on the rack.
And unless you take the Max to Hillsboro and ride there, which is one of my favorite rides.
Okay.
Because that kind of skips the whole west side clusterfuck where there's all that sprawling suburb that's no fun to ride through. But if you can get to Hillsboro, you ride out through some farmland and then you tag the Banks Vernonia Trail, which leads to Stubbs Stewart State Park, which is a great place to camp. And I believe they also have some mountain bike access.
Where it
is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah. They're working on it and trying to make that kind of a one of the meccas.
Yeah. The one thing that Stubbs Stewart lacks is there's no running water. There's no like stream nearby.
That's right.
There might be like a trickle or something, but
they have an RV site, right?
Yeah.
Over there.
They do.
And so, I mean, if you're willing to walk, I don't know, maybe this is like not kosher. I was going to say you could kind of use some of the RV's amenities.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, that's where I would shower if I stayed there. Yeah. But their walk-in area is fantastic. The only thing I miss when I camp there is that I love camping next to a stream. And Gales Creek is good for that because that's where we went last year, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Gales Creek.
But Gales Creek is a little closer to the highway and not always open.
Yeah, I've camped there.
And that's okay.
If you ever camp there on the third weekend of June, all the crazy ham operators will be out there with
their cameras
and antennas all over the place. And
nice.
In Gales Creek?
No, at the
Stubbs Stewart.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that makes more sense. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They're up on that hill.
Real flat and clear. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
nice. Yeah, and you mentioned you were a ham radio enthusiast as well, right?
Yeah, since 57, Morse coder. And it's great fun when you can take a radio that has a third the power of a Christmas tree light bulb, 1 watt. I've talked to Japan Morse code with 1 watt. Which is, you know, your dome light in your car is a blazing beacon of power compared to 1 watt.
Right, right.
So it's amazing what you're bouncing that off the ionosphere back onto the ocean, the ionosphere back to the ocean, the ionosphere into Japan.
Yeah.
With 1 lousy watt.
Science.
With a wire antenna. I don't even have, you know, just 20 feet off the roof, a 60-foot wire.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the living simply thing. That is.
That is amazing.
Yeah. I can go where cell phones don't.
Yeah, yeah.
They even have a method now for if you have a laptop and a 10-watt radio, you can send emails.
Oh, is that right? So it's like a data transfer, like it encodes the data stream into some sort of audio signal?
Yeah, well, one paragraph takes about 10 minutes to send. And
okay.
It ends up hitting some other ham's gateway to the internet that they volunteer to do, and then friends get your email while you're out and, you know, on sitting on Eagle Cap out of a...
Yeah, yeah.
Throw a 60-foot wire up and...
That's fantastic.
It's fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, and that also has a tie into the disaster relief trials because
I was thinking about Ethan's little cargo bike that he has.
Right, because he has the Bullet cargo bike with the ham radio built into it.
Yes.
And then they also had the, I can't remember who it was that was operating the ham radio station there, but they did kind of emergency simulation communication.
I think the ham radio club.
Yeah. Sounds right.
Yeah. I'm a member of that. And then the Ares group, which is the emergency services. So, Most people like to do the handhelds and the local stuff. I like the old shortwave with the long haul, unpredictable strangeness that is pushing 1 watt, you know.
Totally.
6,000 miles.
Well, you can pick up, like you were saying, from Japan or from anywhere. Like you can, you can basically kind of keep an ear open on the world.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take that much technology to do it, is the thing. It's a very simple technology, but very practical and very useful at many points. And very entertaining when it's not practical. So
yeah, with Morse code, you can be fully on the air for $300.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So is that still a licensed thing?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
They don't require the Morse code requirement's gone, so that really helps you. You learn a little theory, and they have really well-designed tests, booklets. People can study and get the licenses in a month or two. They took the Morse code requirement away because they realized not that many people wanted to jump the hoop, but once they get in the hobby, they want to learn it.
Sure.
Just staying on.
You need to widen the gateway.
Yeah.
And then people will learn Morse code in time.
Yeah, because they realize that is the ultimately simple.
Yeah.
And I think the younger generation coming up likes it because they can get off the grid and play, and there's that kind of sense of the, you know, in quotes, the zombie apocalypse. You got to you got to be ready to be self-sustainable kind of thing, and that pushes them a lot into that.
And what is the zombie apocalypse except a metaphor for every other kind of apocalypse?
Just kind of like realize we're getting a crowded warming planet.
Right. Yeah. Any number of things could happen, and it's nice to know how to get in touch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just curious. You mentioned, and I didn't talk about this when you brought it up, but you commuted in Spokane all weather without a car. Were there experiences with that stick out to you?
The one that actually got me to get a car, which was I only rode in extreme situations. I was coming home from a graveyard shift job as a custodian. I have an art degree, so you get, you know, a custodial job.
That's what you get.
And,
yeah.
And it was a good custodial job. But anyway, I came up the South Hill, and I made a right turn to go to my home, and the bike went out from under me, and I slid, and I slid behind a car that was backing out.
What?
But, and I couldn't get up, and I kept falling down. The car's wheels were spinning, but he couldn't get traction. It was a taxi cab that had slid off the road.
Oh.
If he'd gotten traction, he wouldn't have seen me because I was on the ground when I slid up behind him. And so he's spinning around. His rear end of his car is kind of fishtailing around, but he can't get the car to back up. And I'm trying to crawl across and there's people along the sidewalk who are afraid to get off and help me because they're going to fall down because it was just glass ice on this like cobblestone.
Wow.
And so I went home and called my mom and asked if I could borrow $1,000 and buy a car. But I still mostly rode. But, you know, I figured, well, if I'm going to be the one in the car sliding around.
Right. Not the one being slid
yeah,
on,
I mean,
too.
I almost slid under that thing.
That's a very scary experience.
Yeah. I just there are days when maybe, you know, and Spokane was not known for its rapid transit. The particular route I had to go, otherwise I could have just done a bus thing. But
Yeah.
They're probably better now, but that was 70s, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know. There was kind of almost a bell curve of like when transit has been good, because transit maybe back in those days wasn't as good as it got later. But then with budget cuts in today's current economy, transit service is starting to slide back down. So I fear that maybe it's not a bell curve. Maybe it'll actually trend back upwards again in usefulness. But it is interesting to kind of think about when the bus was useful and when it was not. But then it's almost more like a sine wave or something, because there's the times back in the day when the streetcar was the convention, and that was very easy to use, and then that went away.
Yeah, I think we're headed back toward rapid transit. It's just when the economy comes around, it'll come back.
Right.
One of the things that kind of I was going to mention was the bike culture now with the youth. When I was a kid in the 50s, you gave up your bike after mid school, flat out. If you rode your bicycle to high school, it would be destroyed.
Sure.
You were either mad enough to get a car or you were mad enough to walk.
Right.
And I would ride my bike to high school, but I would leave it in my friend's garden shed across the street.
Oh, there we go.
They would literally.
Because you're not a man if you're riding your bike.
It was a paperboy kid thing.
Sure. Oh. And you could do everything else the right way, but if you showed up on a bike, it was culturally unacceptable.
You were toast. It was a 10-speed It seems like the generation ahead of us picked up the 10-speed before my generation did.
Yeah.
It was like older males, women weren't riding at all when the 10-speed came out until the 80s, early 80s. I remember going, being on a Northern California to Monterey along the coast, and we saw a female on a bicycle touring. And we go, wow, that is cool.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That was about the time that Barbara Savage did her epic trek as well.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the...
Yeah, a little bit.
It was Miles from Nowhere? Miles to Nowhere?
Miles to Nowhere, I believe.
That's it, yeah. It's like the quintessential bicycle touring book. But yeah, that was also very, very unusual at that point in time for women to be out on bikes touring particularly. Which is interesting because the bicycle was kind of a symbol of liberation in a lot of ways, like earlier in time. But culture does ebb and flow.
Yeah.
And especially near high school. So, well, is there anything else you'd like to add about this? You said that there was some, you got a little poked fun at by some bicycling magazines back in the day.
Yes, they thought that why would you want a heavy 10-speed bicycle when the whole idea of having a 10-speed bicycle was to get away from that.
Right.
No one saw the idea of dirt. I think, I guess the one comment I wanted to make is that a lot of people feel, talking about the invention of the mountain bike, that if you didn't carry it into production or present it to a larger audience, that you weren't part of the invention. And I feel that some of the Marin County folks feel like that those of us who just made a mountain bike but did nothing with it were kind of dead enders. And I feel like the Marin County guys certainly invented the sport. They certainly invented the bike. They built them in garages. A hippie sold his VW bus to get the money to start Specialized. I mean, it all started in Marin County in terms of the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
But the sparks were out there. There had been tries before that failed. But there seemed to be that the BMX generation was growing up. The sparks were out there that Marin County set the fire, and everybody goes, yeah, we're going to do this. But the fact that there were these inventors scattered around the country, several of which I communicate with, that were the, quote, dead enders,
mm-hmm.
it meant that the world was ready for it.
Right, right. So even if they didn't become successful businessmen and start mountain biking companies, a lot of people contributed to the need for this.
Yeah, and it was a sign that this kind of thing that I did was a sign that people were looking for something more with it, and mm-hmm. Boys of Marin did it along with the boys in Crested Butte.
Yeah.
Boys in Crested Butte kind of started the idea of going over Pearl Pass you probably heard that story about harassing the motorcyclists.
I have not, I remember.
A bunch of rich motorcyclists from Aspen came over Pearl Pass, 12,000 feet or whatever it is,
uh-huh.
into Crested Butte. They had a lot of money and a lot of flash, and Crested Butte was a poor hippie town, and it pissed off the folks from Crested Butte. So the next day, they all got on one speeds, got pretty drunk and pretty high, and they did Pearl Pass. And came crashing into Aspen. To the motorcycle bars.
And they're like, what up, fools?
Yeah, like, what up, bitches? We're here, you know?
That's so awesome.
And so they invited them. They heard about Marin. Marin hadn't heard about them. They invited the Marin boys to come out to the second year.
Yeah.
And the Marin boys showed up with derailleurs.
Nice.
And those were the two subcultures met.
The cross-pollination.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why the Hall of Fame went to Crested Butte, because they actually held an event. I'm not sure when it was they did that, coming in on the motorcyclists, but that was in the very early 70s. And
yeah.
So they've done the Pearl Pass ride every year since.
That's fantastic.
And I would like to do it, but I think being a year off 70, I think I better not try it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I know your limits, right?
Yeah.
That's a great story, though.
Give me a moto and I'll do it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Electric assist.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Thank you so much for bringing stuff out. You have an amazing amount of media, pictures, what have you, that you've delivered here, and we'll find a way to make that available to anyone listening and put that up on the web.
Okay.
And we'll also put up links to stuff that you would like us to link to. So,
okay, yeah, it's just Google Mountain Hot Bike Hall of Fame. Go to History First Bikes, and I'm the second from the bottom on that list.
There we go. Yeah, and the Tank and Yolo.
And if anybody wants to display it, Weir Cycle sold out. I had it there for 10 years. If there's anyone in town who'd like to display the bike and all the pictures I have, you can find me. So
excellent. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Weir Cycles, they have been around for a long time. I believe you said it's the oldest cycle shop in Portland.
Yes, they're still around, but it's no longer owned by the three generations.
It's finally been passed from one dynasty to a new one.
He decided to keep the name because 1924 was when they opened.
Wow. Yeah, that's intense. But
which
very
incidentally
cool.
is where the old my old bike came out of.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I was the second owner, but it still had that Weir Cycle.
Oh, I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, she's still out there somewhere.
She is, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, why don't we do some news and some mail? And would you like another beer?
I would have another beer.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let me get another one for myself as well. Do you
want to
get my ale?
iPod anyways? Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
Excellent. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. And by a short break, I mean I will let the tape run and I will cut it out later.
Yeah.
So here are your headlines for this week.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
From Bike Portland, Marilyn Hayward, owner of Coventry Cycles, tries to rebound from some serious crash. On August 8th of last year, Marilyn Hayward was riding her bike westbound on North Adair Street in Cornelius, a small town about 20 miles west of downtown Portland. As she approached the intersection of 10th Avenue, she was involved in a collision with Gerald Howe. The impact broke Hayward's collarbone and knocked her unconscious. She was rushed to the intensive care unit at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital, where she spent 30 days before being released. Hayward racked up to $160,000 in medical bills. And, oh, I just skipped to edit mode here. Hold on. To add insult to injury, as she says, Howe's insurance company sent her a bill for $4,600 to pay for the dent her body made in his car. What keeps her going is her bike shop. Coventry isn't like any other bike shop around. In addition to deep expertise and connections in the recumbent world, they also serve customers with special needs. I, for one, can attest. Three-wheelers, four-wheelers, hand cycles, Coventry's mechanics are experienced around people who face physical challenges and the bikes that offer them a lifeline.
Yeah, you work with people with kinds of disabilities.
Yeah,
and have you worked with
currently looking for a bike for one of our residences.
Oh.
Coventry was one of the first places we went to.
Okay, yeah.
And they have one that I think would work, but, you know, we're still sort of shopping it around.
Sure.
That's sad.
It is.
To read.
Well, this story came out maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
It's an older story, but I felt like I wanted to make sure we mention it on the show just because Marilyn has done such good things for this special bicycle community. Like anyone who needs something with more than two wheels, definitely she's one of the first options for. And it turns out, some of the details in the article, she kind of explains how after the accident, her brain wasn't necessarily like as it was before the crash.
Oh, wow.
And that I think she said that kind of drove her towards the acquisition of a second location in Beaverton, which wasn't really financially tenable. And so that has since shut down. And they're working on getting their stability back, but it's been tough, obviously.
Yeah.
Like the article said, law enforcement hasn't been compliant. And I think there's some question about like whether or not she was like legally correct in her movements, but I mean she insists that she was, and I would believe her. So
sure. And I was just gonna say, like, by inference, it sounds like the insurance company is trying to hold her liable.
Right.
Or at least the guys, the auto insurance company.
Yeah. So a sad story, but it sounds like she's kind of on the mend. I know there was a great show of support from people who contributed to a fund for some of her medical bills. She was helped out by that. She's obviously still a long ways behind in getting those paid back. But one of the things that they recommend on the website is if you have some bicycle shopping to do, you need like a tube, you need anything, you know, go in, buy it from them. That'll help her out incredibly. So
right on.
So if you're in the Portland area, But good luck, Marilyn. Good luck in recovery. And I know I've been wanting to talk to her and get her onto the show for some time. So whenever is best for her, whenever all this kind of settles down.
Yeah, it would be cool to kind of do a show on like sort of cycling and special needs.
I think. And even just recumbents, normally able recumbent riders. We haven't really talked about any of that stuff yet.
No, that's a whole, I mean, we just got into mountain biking here.
Right,
just
exactly.
This episode. So we got a long ways to go. We got a whole world.
That we do.
Next, The Verge. Architects propose 136 miles of elevated cycleway in London.
Which would be awesome.
Lord Norman Foster. Oh, I'm sorry. Lord Norman Foster, renowned architect and founder of Foster and Partners. That was really not a good English accent there.
It was a good snooty accent, though.
That's true, yeah. Has proposed a massive network of elevated pathways for cyclists in London. Dubbed Sky Cycle, the cycling routes would follow London's vast suburban rail network for over 220 kilometers, 136 miles, allowing cyclists to traverse the UK's capital without encountering cars or pedestrians. Sky Cycle would consist of a number of routes, most of which would connect with other lines at points. Each route would be able to accommodate 12,000 cyclists per hour. The network as a whole would serve almost 6 million people, half of whom live and work within 10 minutes of one of its 200 entrances. As the majority of London's rail network was created in the steam era, the tracks follow the path of least resistance, following steep gradients and avoiding steep gradients and making them ideal routes for cycling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's pretty awesome.
They compared this in the article to... who sent this in, by the way? I forgot.
Oh, sorry.
No worries.
That was from The Verge.
Oh, that's right.
It doesn't
right.
tell us like, who
I think
sent
it was listener Chris, or actually a bunch of folks sent this to me. So pick and choose. Anyone who sent it to me, thank you very much. But this is kind of like what was proposed in L.A., I believe Los Angeles, in the 1920s or so.
Okay.
There was an elevated bike network that was planned and possibly built. I think it might have... it might have been partially constructed, not completed, but there was something like this planned for Los Angeles in the 1920s where you just hop up at the top, ride over everything else, and then hop down to the bottom when you were done.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea.
It sounds like something we should do over here, too.
It does. And I feel like there, I don't remember where, but somewhere else in the world, something like this is either planned or happening.
Okay.
I think they should design it so you zip line down too.
Yes,
with your bike. You just grab your bike and you zip line down.
That was wasn't that Jerry Seinfeld was in a commercial in the past couple of years
where he zip lined
in
with
which
his
there was just a zip line like all the way across New York City or something like that. Seems like a fun idea.
Yeah, I understand they have an urban one, and I wanted an urban one. I wanted to go between buildings. I understand they have one in Las Vegas now.
Do they?
Yeah.
They got a monorail. They have a zip line.
Yeah, I want a zip line from the Astrodome or whatever they call it there, down into the heart of the city.
Yeah, I guess the only thing they don't have is a water supply, but that's, debatable.
Trivia. Yeah,
exactly.
No, they got a water supply. It's just it's everybody else's water.
Well, it's alcohol-based.
The taps run with vodka. Almost as good. So anyways, that's a good idea. I like this. So, hey, you know what time it is? It's time for this. This.
Hey, we got mail.
A donation from Logan.
Thank you, Logan.
Thank you, Logan. Gus shares and the innovative recyclables for transit fare trade option available in Beijing.
Yeah, this is pretty awesome. Basically, like here in Oregon or other states in the U.S. where you would return your bottles and cans for a deposit. In Beijing, apparently, they are obviating one of those steps, and you buy your bus tickets with cans and bottles.
That's pretty cool.
Seems like a good idea.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So I've got like 7 cans here.
Exactly.
Where
That'll
will
get
that
you
take me?
Half a fare.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Of course, like all the bus stations will now smell like booze and,
That is the downside of the bottle return thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And there's always people standing in line like waiting for the reason I don't do more bottle returns, I have a bunch waiting and I really would like those nickels. But it's always like such a long wait to use the machines.
Yeah. So I have a housemate that loves to do that.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And since he uses a wheelchair, we always get to go to the front of the line.
Oh, there you go.
And we usually don't have much more than, like, you know, a couple grocery sacks full.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, everyone, I will say, like, as much as I dislike the smell and the general experience, everyone there has always been really cool to us. Like, once they see us come up, you know, and, you know, our guy in his wheelchair, they're, you know, just with two grocery sacks full of cans or bottles.
That's cool.
And, you know, most of the people there, yeah, they have their, like, big plastic garbage cans full of,
or
garbage bags full.
Well, the limit is something like $7.40 worth or something like
that. Yeah, $144.
Yes.
Yep.
What I've done is I actually did a time trial once where I drove to New Seasons, had my cans, started the watch, and I figured I was making about 75 cents an hour by the time I got out. And so, but we have some certain homeless folks that come by our house with their carts and all. So I, you know, befriend one of them, let them know that I'm hiding them beside the house on recycling day, because they come rolling through when our trash pickup is. And so I had a couple for like 10 years that would come by, and we'd gab with them and they'd pick up the cans.
Nice. You have an arrangement.
That's cool. Yeah.
So they don't just end up in the recycling, straight up recycling someone. Someone
right.
Get somebody that really needs it.
Someone will get those deposits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Works out.
Yeah, that, and I think someone at one point offered to buy a bag of cans from me for like what he estimated to be about the value of the bag, which if you got to work with bottles and cans for a while to figure that out, but I think he was fairly accurate.
Wow.
Yeah, that's working hard for a living.
Man. I think that was worth it for both parties. I think I was happy, he was happy, so yeah.
Cool. Next, Christopher in Wyoming shares the heartwarming story of the 66-year-old man who won the race across Sweden.
This is fantastic.
After being barred from official entry due to his age.
Wow.
After riding 600 miles to the start line, he won the race by skipping overnight sleep in favor of a short nap and many dark hours of riding. That's why they call him the Iron Grandpa.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great...
that is amazing.
Great article from some British publisher, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah. So thanks, Christopher. Good story.
Yeah. That's sweet.
Former guest Sally on Twitter caught up with a few back episodes of the Sprocket podcast, kind of like binge-watching The Walking Dead. Yeah, yeah, very much like it.
Exactly. And I think I replied that it's because we shamble about
and
groan.
Much nihilism and groaning.
That's right.
Daniel on Ellie Blue's Amtrak kerfuffle. Thank you, Ellie Blue, for standing up for your rights. As a resident of San Antonio, Texas, I can attest to the attitude towards bicycles, folding or otherwise. It goes something like this. Oh my God, it's a bicycle. The shock and attitude is like I flashed them my privates or something. Well, I do have a Montague paratrooper, and I do have a bicycle travel bag for it. The brand of the bag is Nashbar and is able to roll up and fit into a 15-liter pannier. My experience has been that the Megabus are assholes and don't allow it. Amtrak charged me $10 to check it from San Antonio to Austin, and so far Greyhound has accepted it free of charge as checked luggage. The only hassle I had was in Austin in the Greyhound station, where they wanted to know how heavy it was. It was only 45 pounds, so guys, keep it under 50.
Excellent. That's a very detailed breakdown of what to do with your bike in Texas, which is good.
Yeah.
Thanks, Daniel.
Awesome. From Patrick in Davis, California. Happy New Year, Brock and Aaron. Really enjoyed episode 164 with Thunder Island Brewing. By the way, did you know it's really unlucky to sing that in a bar when it's not New Year's?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good thing we're not in a bar.
Got the beers, but no bar.
Seriously.
I don't know. I want to go to a bar that I really hate and just start singing that.
have a helicopter crash into it or an oil train blow up beside it like we've had recently.
Wow.
anyways, I'm lucky to live near a great microbrewery, Barry Essa Brew Company, that has become a cornerstone of the community, and I hope the same happens for Thunder Island Brewing and Cascade Locks.
So do I.
Yes.
And I got to try this Barry Essa now.
Yeah, where is that at?
I believe it's down in Davis.
In Davis.
Or somewhere nearby.
All right. Oh, yeah. And then he also sent us a picture.
Yeah. Is it there? Do you see it?
Of a bikeway on UC Davis, Sprocket Bikeway.
Which is fantastic. Now we have to go there someday.
Yeah, we have to ride it there and like, get our pictures taken next to it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then maybe you know, put one of our stickers on the sign itself.
Well, I think that'd be...
Or somebody should do
that. Someone would do that. It wouldn't be us.
We wouldn't condone that.
No, sir. That would be wrong.
We wouldn't do that ourselves.
But I sure hope it happens.
From the Stick Man in Vegas, this is epic.
Oh.
The Verge architects propose... Oh, hey,
okay.
That's the same thing.
It was the Stick Man. Thank you,
yeah,
Stick Man.
Yeah, Stick Man. All right.
There we go. All right.
Cool. From Nick on Twitter, listening to the episode with Ellie Blue, thought you might like this. A tall bike with tandem chain setup, cable steering, adjustable height, and disassembles for travel.
It's like the best bike ever.
That is pretty cool. I see a few of these pictures here.
Yeah, and it's all like detail shots, so there's no picture of
the actual
entire bike. But it is green with purple pedals, which is pretty fantastic.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, Mr. Bob, I will have to show you my tall bike before you take off.
It was built by
Tom Labonte of Tom's Cargo Bikes. Well, hey, that's our show. Let's say goodbye to the good people, and we'll be back next week with more. Pleasure having everyone in here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Bob.
Absolutely.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. You can also text us to that number. Connect with us on Twitter at The Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder. Find them at hurtbirdmusic.com. And thanks to Shadow Fox for his reoccurring donation.
All right.
Everybody,
adieu.
Go to bed.
Ride your
brush
mountain
your
bike.
Teeth. Lock your bike.
Go with.
Also, our recurring donation from Shadow Fox.
Oh.
His name is Shadow Fox.
His name is Shadow Fox.
Heretofore to be referred to as.
Thank you, Shadow Fox.
Yes.
Wait, is this the same? Is this an additional?
Same donor.
Oh, same donor.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All
so
right.
His name is Shadow Fox.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's another donor.
Oh, no. No, you're
no,
not
no,
allowed.
No, you're
not
a
allowed.
Guest.
Not allowed?
No.
Tell guests can't donate?
Guests are not allowed to donate.
No.
It's nice of you, but you're not.
That borders on bribery.
Seriously.
Oh, okay. I'll put the $700 back in my wallet.
Okay, easy enough. This is going to go up tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. It will go up tomorrow. All right. Let's wrap this up. A Sprocket Studios production.